I want you to imagine a world where your smartphone can make a flawless, like 4K video call from the absolute middle of the Sahara Desert.
Right, just you, the sand dunes, and perfect high definition video.
Exactly, just totally seamless. Now, while you're imagining making that call, consider this. The world's multi-billion dollar tech companies are right now locked in this brutal battle for absolute global supremacy to make things like that happen.
Yeah, but they aren't fighting over software.
No, they aren't fighting over lines of code at all. They're fighting over raw electricity.
It's a really profound paradigm shift because for decades, the tech industry just kind of operated on this assumption that digital growth was infinite and weightless.
Like it didn't take up any physical space.
Right. But we are now moving from a purely digital arms race to an entirely physical one. And it's basically governed by the laws of thermodynamics and civil engineering.
Welcome to this deep dive. We are pulling from a really fascinating stack of sources for this one. We've got the April 30th, 2026 edition of the Tekin Morning Newsletter.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah, it gives us all the hard-breaking data on these infrastructure shifts. And we're pairing that with some really brilliant recent insights from the Awake Technology podcast.
They've been closely tracking the geopolitical and really the societal ripples of this whole hardware revolution.
Right. So our mission today is simple. We want to pierce right through the usual hype around AI and shiny next-gen gadgets. We are going to look at the physical realities.
Massive infrastructure.
Exactly. The power grids, the satellite chips, even international patents, the things that are secretly, quietly dictating the actual future of technology. Okay, let's unpack this. Because before any artificial intelligence can be smart, it has to live somewhere physical.
Yeah, we talk about the cloud all the time,
Yeah,
right?
all the time.
But the cloud isn't actually in the sky. The cloud consists of millions of spinning hard drives and processors sitting inside massive concrete buildings on the ground.
And that ground is currently the most contested real estate on the planet.
Absolutely. Like, if you look at the themes covered recently on the Awake Technology podcast, they've been detailing this U.S.-China technology war.
Right.
And for a long time, the public perception was that this war was about who had the smartest engineers
Right.
or, the most advanced algorithms.
Right. Who could write the best code?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the reality is far more industrial. If you are a massive Chinese AI firm today, say Baidu, Alibaba, or ByteDance, you face a fundamental physical capacity constraint.
You literally do not have the buildings or the power to train the next massive language model at the speed your US competitors can.
Yeah.
The numbers from the India AI Impact Summit that came out this April make that gap just painfully clear. The United States has decisively won the AI infrastructure war.
Won it handily.
Yeah. The US now has 4,032 active data centers. That is 37% of the global total.
Wow.
Yeah. And China, on the other hand, operates only 368 data centers. That's just 3.4% of the global total. And India is sitting at fewer than 200.
That's a staggering difference.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it doesn't stop there. Global compute capacity is projected to double to 200 gigawatts by 2030. And 65% of that new growth is expected to happen strictly on US soil.
See, what's fascinating here is the underlying limitation creating that massive disparity. Because the bottleneck preventing China or India from simply pouring more concrete and, buying more servers, it's not a lack of capital. It's
Right.
not even a lack of networking technology. It is the energy bottleneck.
Okay, the energy bottleneck. Walk us through that.
Well, modern AI data centers are uniquely power hungry. And standard data center from, say, 10 years ago, it might have drawn 5 or 10 megawatts. But a single modern AI training facility consumes anywhere from 50 to 100 megawatts of continuous power.
I actually dug into what 100 megawatts actually means for a local utility grid, and it's pretty staggering. That is enough electricity to power roughly 50,000 average homes. So every time a tech company decides to build a new AI data center, they are essentially dropping the power requirements of a small city onto the local grid. You can't just plug that into a standard industrial park.
Precisely. And this is why the U.S. holds such a commanding lead. The U.S. possesses a highly robust, mature electrical grid, and it's heavily augmented by massive recent investments in renewable energy, like solar and wind, alongside a stable nuclear baseline.
Right.
So combine that with a relatively open business environment, with, you know, manageable regulatory friction, and utilities can actually handle plugging in these small digital cities.
Whereas China and India face severe grid constraints.
Right. They regularly deal with industrial brownouts and massive regulatory hurdles regarding power distribution. You simply cannot turn on a 100-megawatt AI facility if the local municipal grid cannot guarantee uninterrupted electricity.
Because if the power drops for even a fraction of a second,
you lose weeks of computational progress during a massive model training run. It's devastating.
Okay, so it's like trying to build the world's biggest water park, right? China has a garden hose, while the U.S. has access to a massive reservoir.
That's a great way to put it.
Think about it like industrial agriculture. You can have the best genetically modified seeds in the world, the smartest botanists, but if you don't own the water rights to irrigate the fields, nothing is going to grow.
And the U.S. owns the water rights. The compute sovereignty of the 21st century isn't tied to software. It's fundamentally tied to utility grids.
Okay, so securing those water rights, to use our little framework here, it's creating absolute shockwaves through the global financial sector. I mean, how much is this massive U.S. build-out actually costing?
The sheer scale of what is required to build out this physical footprint is, frankly, unprecedented.
Right, because buying the land and pouring the concrete is one thing, but outfitting these massive warehouses with specialized cooling systems and thousands of high-end GPUs, that is astronomical.
Oh, yeah.
The tech giants, Amazon, Meta, Alphabet, Microsoft, they're planning $650 billion in capital expenditure, or CapEx, for 2026 alone.
Just for 1 year.
Just for 2026. And according to JLL's 2026 Global Data Center Outlook, we are entering an infrastructure supercycle that will require up to $3 trillion by 2030.
And we should really break down where that $3 trillion is actually going.
Hmm.
Because roughly $1.2 trillion is earmarked purely for the real estate.
Wow.
Yeah, the land acquisition, the specialized structural engineering, the liquid cooling infrastructure, the massive electrical substations. And then the remaining $1 to $2 trillion is for the actual IT equipment inside the building. The servers, the fiber optics, the GPUs.
The Tech and Morning newsletter actually highlighted a statistic that really puts this into perspective. Data center construction in the U.S. has now reached $42.1 billion annually.
That's wild.
And what's crazy is that historically eclipses general office construction, which sits at $40.5 billion.
Wait, really?
Yeah. We are now spending more money building houses for computers than we are building offices for human beings. It's reached 1.2% of the entire U.S. GDP.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you can see why the stock market is behaving so erratically. Investors are oscillating between the fear of missing out on the AI revolution and the sheer terror of footing a $3 trillion bill.
Right.
Look at the market reactions from late April. Meta dropped 1.2% and Amazon fell 0.8%, almost entirely based on Wall Street's anxiety over these massive CapEx numbers.
Because the spending is so massive, it's cutting into their traditional profit margin.
Exactly. But then, on the exact same day, Microsoft rose 1.1% because they demonstrated actual, tangible revenue growth directly tied to their Azure AI services.
Well, and it's not just the traditional AI models driving this market anxiety either. The newsletter also covered how NVIDIA recently launched its Ising open source AI model family.
Oh, right.
And the market interpreted this launch as NVIDIA effectively using AI to validate and accelerate quantum computing, which sent quantum computing stocks like IonQ surging up 5.2%. It added over $1 billion to its market cap almost overnight.
Which subsequently triggered a massive panic in the cybersecurity sector. EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, immediately had to convene a panel to address post-quantum cryptography.
Because if quantum computing gets accelerated...
The mechanism here is critical, yeah. Modern encryption relies on mathematical problems that would take a traditional computer thousands of years to solve. But if AI can accelerate the development of stable quantum computers, those quantum machines could potentially factor those massive equations in seconds.
Breaking current global encryption standards.
Exactly. Breaking everything.
So you have this dynamic where the stock market is basically ping-ponging between the terror of how much it costs to build the future and the terror of what actually happens if the technology succeeds and breaks everything.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder if we are seeing a totally rational upgrade of global infrastructure or if we are watching the inflation of a massive bubble.
Well, industry analysts are fiercely divided on that exact question. The historical parallels being drawn are the 1870s railroad boom or the 1990s telecom crash.
Okay, tell me about the 90s comparison.
In the 90s, Companies spent billions laying down miles of underwater fiber optic cables, and they vastly overestimated consumer demand. When the dot-com bubble burst, much of that fiber sat dark and unused for years. It bankrupted the companies that laid it.
Right.
The consensus today is that the true test won't happen this year. The crucible will be in 2027 or 2028. That is when the market will demand to see if the actual AI inference workloads, you know, the daily routine tasks you and millions of others ask AI to perform, actually generate enough revenue to justify a $3 trillion physical buildout.
But wait, I have to push back a bit on the 1990s telecom bubble comparison, though. In the late 90s, the market was driven by companies like Pets.com that had like expensive Super Bowl commercials, but functionally zero revenue.
Sure.
They were pure speculation. Today, the companies driving this CapEx, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, they are deeply entrenched, utility-like entities generating billions in free cash flow every quarter. Like you mentioned, Microsoft is already proving that their Azure AI integration is driving real paying enterprise demand.
And that's a very fair point.
Yeah.
The fortress-like balance sheets of these tech giants absolutely provide a different foundation than the startups of the 90s.
Yeah.
They can absorb a massive amount of capital destruction without going bankrupt.
Exactly.
However, the risk mechanism is different. The question isn't whether AI is valuable. The question is whether the revenue ceiling of AI matches the $3 trillion floor of the infrastructure.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, if consumer demand for AI plateaus, like if people decide they only need AI to summarize emails and not to fully automate their businesses, even a behemoth like Meta could face a massive depreciation crisis as these billion-dollar data centers sit running at 20% capacity.
Okay, that makes sense. So on one side, you have American and Chinese megacorporations fighting a literal trillion-dollar war over physical concrete, cooling towers, and electricity. But for smaller nations who simply do not have the geographic scale, the water rights, or the capital to build 100-megawatt data centers, they have to find a completely different way to secure their place in the future economy.
Right.
They have to build a different kind of infrastructure.
Intellectual property.
Yes. And this brings us to a really fascinating development out of the Middle East. Between April 25th and April 29th, Sultan Qaboos University in Oman filed two brand new patents. But they didn't just file them locally.
No, they didn't.
They filed them with the United States Patent and Trademark Office. The USPTO.
And the geopolitical signaling of that specific filing location is vital, because Sultan Qaboos University has spent the last decade quietly building deep research capabilities. They heavily focus on engineering, complex chemical synthesis, and unmanned vehicle systems.
Right.
But filing a USPTO patent shifts their work from an academic achievement to a strategic economic maneuver.
For you listening who might wonder why a university in Oman cares about a U.S. patent, think of it like standardizing the gauge of a railroad track in a newly discovered territory.
Well, that's a good analogy.
Oman isn't just releasing a single product. They are attempting to patent the fundamental technological tracks. By legally protecting those tracks in the United States, which is the largest consumer and technology market on Earth, they force any global tech giant who wants to build a train on those tracks to pay Oman a toll.
It's like a talented local indie band finally deciding to put their music on a global streaming platform.
Yeah.
They aren't just playing local gigs anymore. They're demanding the world stage.
Yeah.
And it ties directly into a broader national strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, Gulf nations like Oman, alongside the UAE and Saudi Arabia, have economies deeply anchored to the export of oil and gas.
Right.
But Oman is aggressively pursuing an initiative called Vision 2040, which is designed to transition the country away from fossil fuel dependence and into a knowledge-based economy.
Mm.
Filing internationally enforced patents is a measurable indicator of that transition. It demonstrates global commercial intent.
And it really shifts the dynamics in that specific region. Because if you look at the Middle East historically, technology innovation and patent filings have been overwhelmingly dominated by Israel and Turkey.
Right.
Israel routinely files around 1,800 international patents every single year, heavily concentrated in cybersecurity, software, and defense tech. And Turkey has cultivated a massive, booming startup ecosystem. But the entire Arab world historically files fewer than 500 combined international patents a year.
So Sultan Qaboos University, stepping onto the USPTO stage, is a calculated move to close that regional gap. Because intellectual property creates a gravity well.
A gravity well.
Yeah. When a nation demonstrates that it can generate and internationally protect cutting-edge research, it attracts top-tier global talent. Engineers and scientists want to work where their innovations are legally shielded and commercially viable.
That makes total sense.
Right. It lays the groundwork for global joint ventures. For a nation of about 5 million people, establishing that robust intellectual infrastructure provides economic leverage that simply cannot be achieved by trying to outbuild American data centers.
It's a brilliant way to bypass physical constraints on the ground. But, you know, there is another way to bypass physical constraints on the ground.
Oh.
And that is by abandoning the ground entirely and putting your infrastructure in orbit.
Yes. The democratization of satellite connectivity.
Exactly. For years, if you needed to make a phone call via satellite, you were usually a maritime worker or like a deep sea explorer carrying a massive, bulky, multi-$1,000 piece of specialized hardware, like an Iridium phone.
Yeah, those big clunky things.
Recently, we saw Apple introduce emergency SOS texting on the iPhone 14, which was great for emergencies, but incredibly limited. But as of April 29th, 2026, the game has officially changed. Satellite voice and video calling is transitioning from a niche luxury to a standard smartphone feature.
The mechanism driving this transition is a specific, highly advanced piece of silicon, the Exynos modem 5410.
Yeah, both Samsung's new Galaxy S26 and the Infinix Note 60 Ultra are equipped with this chip. It enables something called LTE Direct-to-Cell, or DTC.
Right.
This means you can initiate a full voice call or a live video stream from literally anywhere on the planet, the middle of the ocean, a remote mountain peak, wherever, without needing a massive external antenna.
We should probably explain the physics of how this chip actually achieves this, because punching a high bandwidth signal through miles of atmosphere to a satellite moving at 17,000 miles per hour is incredibly difficult.
Oh, absolutely.
So the Exynos 5410 handles this by integrating three distinct communication modes onto a single microscopic die. First, you have the LTE DTC, which handles your standard voice and video by utilizing advanced error correction. That compensates for the massive latency and Doppler shift of communicating with low Earth orbit satellites.
Okay, so that's the heavy lifter for the 4K video calls we mentioned at the start of the deep dive.
Yes. But if weather conditions are terrible, or the satellite angle is poor, the chip dynamically shifts to its second mode, NB-IoT NTN, or Narrowband IoT Non-Terrestrial Networks.
Okay, and what does that do?
This is a low-throughput, sparse data mode. Think of it as the ultra-reliable, slow-lane fallback layer. It strips out the video and voice, ensuring that at the bare minimum, emergency telemetry and text data still get through the interference.
Got it.
And finally, the chip includes NRNTN, which is a direct 5G satellite connection, effectively future-proofing the hardware for when the orbital satellite constellations are upgraded to handle native 5G bandwidth.
The technical gymnastics happening inside that chip are just incredible. But what is truly revolutionary to me is the democratization aspect. This technology isn't just reserved for people buying $2,000 flagship devices anymore.
No, it's not.
While Samsung is putting it in their S26, Infinix is integrating this exact same Exynos chip into the Note 60 Ultra, which targets emerging markets and retails for under $900. Yeah. They are bringing true, uncensorable, anywhere on Earth connectivity to global demographics that have historically been totally excluded from this level of infrastructure.
This raises an important question regarding disaster resilience, actually. When we consider the societal implications, we often think of the extreme sports enthusiast out in the wilderness. But imagine you live in an area prone to severe weather.
Right.
When a hurricane or a massive wildfire inevitably destroys the physical cell towers in your region, these phones instantly become lifelines. The communication grid doesn't completely collapse anymore. First responders, citizens, they stay connected. Governments and emergency management agencies are already looking at how a widely distributed network of satellite-capable civilian phones changes their disaster response strategies.
Now, we should clarify for anyone listening who is, you know, ready to go off the grid right now, the hardware is built into the phone, but the service itself still costs money.
Yes. Yeah. Satellite calling isn't free.
No. While basic SOS might be cheap, current estimates suggest that unlimited voice and video via satellite will require a subscription of around $15 to $25 a month, or a pay-as-you-go rate of $1 to $2 per minute. But the simple fact that the capability rests in your pocket is staggering.
Absolutely.
But here's where it gets really interesting. There is a massive, highly controversial caveat to this rollout for premium buyers.
Oh, the hardware segmentation on the premium models.
Exactly. Imagine you go out today and spend top dollar on the absolute highest end model Samsung offers, the Galaxy S26 Ultra, starting at $11,199.
Right.
You take it on a remote hiking trip, assuming you have the best technology money can buy. But if you try to make a satellite video call, it will fail. The S26 Ultra does not have satellite calling capability.
Wait, really? The Ultra doesn't have it?
It does not. It perfectly highlights the hidden trade-offs in global supply chains. It's all because of the processor. All Galaxy S26 Ultra models worldwide are manufactured using the Snapdragon processor instead of Samsung's own Exynos chip.
Oh, I see.
And because the Snapdragon configuration does not include the Exynos 5410 modem, it physically lacks the hardware to communicate with the satellites.
It's a hardware issue.
It is a hard physical limitation. You cannot patch it with a software update. So you have a situation where the ultra-premium buyers are totally locked out of the biggest technological breakthrough of the year.
It creates a fascinating strategic dilemma. I mean, Samsung made a calculated engineering decision. The Snapdragon processor is historically favored for sustained graphical performance and thermal management, which the demographic buying the Ultra demands for, you know, heavy mobile gaming and multitasking.
Right.
But by prioritizing traditional performance continuity, they had to sacrifice the marquee connectivity feature of 2026. This completely upends the traditional consumer expectation that paying the maximum price guarantees you every available feature.
Totally.
If you are a consumer who values remote connectivity or travel safety, you are now heavily incentivized to buy the cheaper standard S26 or even the competitor's Infinix device over the flagship Ultra model.
I can only imagine the frustration of a buyer realizing their $1,200 device is a brick in the woods while their friend's $800 phone is streaming video via space.
Seriously.
It really forces you to reevaluate what premium actually means in a world where constant connectivity is becoming the baseline.
It forces us to reevaluate the entire foundation of our digital lives, honestly.
Absolutely. So what does this all mean for you as you navigate this rapidly changing landscape? Whether we are talking about the autonomous AI agents organizing your life that the Awake podcast tracks, the global patent war shifting the balance of economic power, or just the smartphone sitting in your pocket right now,
yeah.
Everything digital is anchored to the physical.
Yeah.
We've been conditioned to think of the future as invisible data magically floating in the air. But the truth is, the future is incredibly heavy. It is made of millions of tons of concrete data centers, copper wires, specialized silicon modems, and orbital real estate.
If we connect all of these threads, the massive power requirements of AI, the multi-trillion-dollar infrastructure builds, and the push to bypass terrestrial grids entirely with satellites, it leads to a final, rather provocative thought.
Let's hear it.
If the true bottleneck for the future of artificial intelligence and global connectivity isn't the code, but rather the power grids and physical infrastructure, we have to ask a fundamental question.
Okay.
Will the tech giants of the 2030s even look like software companies anymore?
Mm.
Or, by necessity, will they effectively become the world's largest energy and utility providers?
Wow. That is something to seriously chew on. You imagine that 4K video call from the middle of the Sahara Desert and you realize it might not be a software company connecting you. It might be a global energy and utility empire that just happens to write code on the side.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. It has been an absolute blast unpacking the physical reality of the future with you. We'll see you next time.